Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Right here in New York City, you can walk by physical evidence of our country's long and consistent history of white supremacy and New York's role in it. You've probably jogged by one of these examples or glanced at it on your way to a concert at Pier 17. There is a plaque at the base of Wall Street where the slave market that stretched from Pearl to Water Street operated for decades. About 300 years later, after its closure, and some 70-plus blocks uptown at the Town Hall Theater, in a talk, lecture-slash-history lesson, legal scholar Jeffrey Robinson would cite that Wall Street example and so many other places and moments in our country's history to explain how we got to the point where we can have satellites orbit in space, carry powerful computers in our back pockets, and yet cannot achieve racial equity in this country. In a sobering new documentary, Who We Are, A Chronicle of Racism in America, Robinson argues that we as a nation have come to the precipice of an important racial tipping point. Let's listen to a little bit of the trailer.
We had been on a path toward racial justice that was amazing. There was the Civil Rights Act, the Voting Rights Act. We were at a tipping point. We're 50 years later now. Once again, America is having to look at issues of race dead in the eye, and once again, we are at a tipping point. And the question for all of us in this room is, what are we gonna do about it?
Well, I'm walking and talking with my mind.
If I make the statement to you, America was founded on white supremacy.
I'm walking and talking with my mind.
You could say, Jeff, that's an extreme statement. And what I would say to you is, don't believe a word I say about it. All you have to do is go look.
Slavery had nothing to do with the war because they were treated as family.
I don't know if he can be reached, but if no one tries, he definitely won't change.
Lynchings took place in this very spot. Everybody needs to know what happened because it's a part of our history, American history.
America has demonstrated its greatness time and time again, and America is one of the most racist countries on the face of the earth. Those two things are not mutually exclusive.
The film brings Robinson's stage presentation to life by visiting the locations he cites in his work, some of them where the most egregious racial incidents in our country's history took place. He takes us to that imposing oak tree that was used for lynching and now stands in this picturesque tiny little park. These moments in the film provide context with the help of historians, first-person testimonies from those who experienced racial violence or had loved ones killed because of hate, including Robinson's own history with the civil rights movement. Jeffrey Robinson is an attorney and former deputy director of the ACLU, and he joins us now. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, how are you?
I'm well, thank you. It was directed by sisters Emily and Sarah Kunstler, whose production company Off Center Media creates both documentaries and clemency video projects. Their last feature, Disturbing the Universe, was about growing up with their famous dad, legendary attorney William Kunstler. Emily and Sarah, welcome.
Hi, thanks for having us. Thank you.
The film Who We Are...
Allison, if you don't mind, I just need to say I was the deputy legal director because the deputy director at the ACLU is probably turning somersaults now.
I'm noting that right now. Writing it in there. Don't want anybody turning somersaults. But I do want people to know this. Who We Are, A Chronicle of Racism in America is in theaters now, playing in New York City at the Film Forum and at Lincoln Center. So, Jeff, you say in the film, so you had this amazing education. You went to Marquette, Harvard Law School. But there was so much that you didn't know. What made you realize that?
In 2011, circumstances in my family resulted in my nephew, who lived in New York, moving to Seattle to live with me and my wife and becoming our son. His mother died, and then his grandmother died, and they were raising him. And so all of a sudden, we didn't have kids before, and there was a young Black man living in my home. He was 13 years old, and all the things I had worked on for almost three decades as a criminal defense lawyer about racism in the criminal legal system, racism in our society, all of a sudden it took on a different aspect because this kid was in my home. And I think I panicked, and I was terrified to be a parent, and I started looking for help, and I was reading. And I didn't really find the help I was looking for in what I was reading, but I found something else. And what I found was that I did not know the history of white supremacy and anti-Black racism because I had never been taught it. And it took me a minute to realize that I had never been taught it, because at first I was just ashamed and angry and humiliated, feeling, how could I not know this? I was born in 1956 and I grew up in the middle of the civil rights movement. That wasn't something I read about in a book. So how could I not know this history? And I went from blaming myself to blaming my teachers. And then it went from there to, how could they teach it if they didn't know it? So that's kind of how this got started.
As you began investigating the material and crafting this presentation, what narrative took shape?
I was trained as a criminal defense lawyer and a trial lawyer. And one of the things that we're trained to do is to take an incredibly complicated set of facts and put them in a timeline and then see what it looks like. And when I put this stuff in a timeline, the top of my head came off, because it was a clear an unbroken line from 1619 to today that answers or gives a very different critical answer, a very different partial answer to the question, why does America look like it does today when it comes to the gap between white and Black people? And that's a critical question.
Such an important question, too, when people ask or have the conversation, well, why do I need to know this? Okay, if I know this history, so what? But in my mind, it brings us to every vote we make, every bill that's proposed, every kind of, when you're talking about civil rights voting and civil rights legislation and the Voting Rights Act, voting suppression, if you don't know the history of it, you don't understand why it's so important.
Well, I think this is what's critical. Many Americans saw the killing of George Floyd and thought, oh my God, this is so outrageous. It's so, you know, extreme. And, you know, there were many of us who, I mean, you can't laugh because there's nothing funny about it, but it's like, if you think this is unique, no, the thing that's unique is cell phones and video cameras and the fact that everything can be recorded. And so I think if you think about it like this, if you have a problem, and that problem being racial inequity in America, and you want to solve that problem, and you solve that problem from a standpoint of believing that America was always about freedom and equality. America had a little problem with slavery, but then we cured that. And then we had the civil rights movement, and everything has been fine since then. If that's the background against which you look at the problems today, then you might come to a conclusion like Jared Kushner, who said, well, you know, President Trump can't want Black people to be successful more than they want to be successful. And so that just puts the blame on lack of initiative and effort in the Black community. But if you instead understood that there was an unbroken line from 1619 until today that explains the vast majority of the disparities between white America and Black America, then when you're coming up with a solution, you will try to solve for the problem that actually happened and the things that actually caused the present circumstances, instead of trying to solve for someone's opinion that's based on a myth of American history that's just not true.
Emily, how did you know you wanted to make this film?
Well, Sarah had the opportunity, Sarah's an attorney as well, and she had the opportunity to see Jeff in a continuing legal education course in Manhattan in 2017. And she called me afterwards and said, there's this amazing guy, this amazing presentation. She had like taken some notes. She was trying to quote him to me. I was like, slow down, you know, let's see what we can find. I'm sure if he's this amazing, he's got some online presence, you know, I'm sure this presentation, we can find it somewhere. So I did some searches and we really couldn't find anything. We found bits and pieces here and there, but there was nothing. So we thought, wow, you know, we're filmmakers. At the very least, let's help Jeff get this out there so that when someone sees his presentation, they can actually share it with others. So we cold called Jeff, having never met him before, met him for coffee. He had hot chocolate. We went from there, managed to convince him to take us along with him on this tremendous journey.
You are a filmmaker. You notice that detail. So Sarah, as an attorney, what appealed to you about this project, and then also as a filmmaker?
I mean, Jeff knows how to put an argument together. He knows how to marshal facts, and he knows how to persuade. And, you know, and that's what you would want from any good trial lawyer. But more than that, Jeff is a generous presenter who invites audiences of all races in to listen to learn this history. You know, when Jeff starts his presentation, he says, "This is a history that has been stolen from all of us. And it's our collective obligation as Americans to reclaim it, to get it back." And it's that generosity with which he takes audiences in, that really appealed to me, because it was a talk that that I thought appealed to me as a white audience member, but that I thought would appeal to audiences of all races in reckoning with and reclaiming this history.
So, Emily, Jeff's talk is clearly engaging, and it's very clear, and it's academic in the best way, like the best class you've ever been to. But how do you make a film out of that? When did you decide that you would take it out of the theater? This could have been just a straight presentation.
Well, Jeff's the best teacher that either Sarah and I have ever had. If we had just recorded this presentation and shown it to audiences, it would have been riveting. But we really wanted to capture that experience that Sarah had the first time she saw him, which was she couldn't look at the world the same way again. And it's hard to do that with a PowerPoint presentation, a recorded PowerPoint presentation, if you're not seeing Jeff in the flesh. So we knew we'd have to bring some more elements into this. Jeff was luckily traveling around the country giving his presentations. He actually still does that. Mm-hmm. So we just traveled with him and with our producers, and wherever we would go, we would identify stories that would be bring elements of his presentation to life, that would, you know, invite the power of narrative. I mean, that's the one thing, this overlap between being a lawyer and being a documentary filmmaker. It's really harnessing the power of narrative. And telling these first-person stories really brought this message home to audiences. First-person stories of the people we met that had the true lived experiences of the stories Jeff talked about in his presentation, and also Jeff's first-person story, talking about his experience in growing up during the Civil Rights Movement, his personal experiences of discrimination, sharing some of the experiences that formed his opinions and why he's doing what he's doing.
Jeff, what was the most difficult thing to share personally? Because there's a memoir element to the film.
I think all of it was difficult to share. When Emily and I and Sarah and I first started talking about this, I was saying I don't want anything about me in the film. And that's because this film is not about me. And I thought a lot during the presentation. I called my parents unicorns, and I completely and totally believe that because of what they did in their own lives and what they did to give their children advantages. But I want everybody to understand there were Black unicorn parents all over America. Unicorns, you know, are rare, except when it comes to parents in the Black community. And so many people I've talked to in the Black community who say, you know, I had an experience just like that, or I had this happen to me that's like completely parallel. And that's because that's what Black parents were doing at that, and they're still doing, giving their kids the best chance they have under incredibly difficult circumstances. But Sarah and Emily are very, very persuasive people. And they kept talking to me about it, even when I said no. And I think what I finally came to, two things. They told me, consider yourself a character in a film. Don't think about it as you, because it's very, very difficult. And the second thing was, we went to Tulsa, Oklahoma. Dr. Tiffany Crutcher brought her parents to the church where I gave my 3-hour presentation. I warned them that there would be a video of their son or twin brother being shot. And I think they left during that and came back in. Tiffany Crutcher sat down and interviewed with us for hours. She took us to her home and introduced us to her parents. Her mother has passed away since then. And if she could do all of that in order to help us tell this story. We talked about school desegregation, and I had an experience with that. And we talked about redlining and the Fair Housing Act, and I had an experience with that. So I'm really glad that Sarah and Emily pushed me to do this, because I think it made the film better.
My grandparents got their house the same way your parents did. You know, that experience.
And that's the thing. That's the thing. It's like, oh, my God, that's so unique. And I'm like, actually, it's not, because this is what was going on during that time.
Mm-hmm. My guests are Jeffrey Robinson and producers and directors Emily Sen, Sarah Kunstler. We're talking about the film Who We Are, A Chronicle of Racism in America. So early on, there's this incredibly memorable exchange where Jeff speaks to a man at a MIDI Confederate flag rally. And you're really trying to understand. You're really trying to engage with him. And then he says that enslaved people were treated like family. And you have a poker face, but not that good at one. That's just all I'm going to say in that moment. You were poised, but man. First, I'm going to ask.
The first things in my head that were about to come out of my mouth were words that I probably can't say on the radio, but those just got swallowed.
I'm going to ask you a question in a moment, Jeff, but Sarah, I'll ask you, what did you think watching that exchange? Because on one level, as a filmmaker, you're like, oh, filmmaker gold. But on the other side, you're a human being.
Yeah, well, we actually, you know, Jeff, we went down to that protest without Jeff. Jeff wasn't feeling well that morning, so we didn't even know if he was going to show up. And we started that interview with the Confederate protesters or Confederate flag supporters before Jeff got there. And I think that was actually a really good thing, because when they agreed to interview us, when they signed release forms, they thought they were speaking to a group of white people. If Jeff had been there at that moment, we don't know whether they would have agreed to the interview, but by the time he got there, the cameras were already rolling. You want to say something?
Yeah, and it's, you know, that day, the day before that, we had been at the Slave Mart Museum looking at shackles that were made for 3 to 5 year olds, enslaved children. So, you know, we had already had this really profound experience in that city. So listening in that context to hear this man talk about his opinions in that context was really hard. But it wasn't just the conversation Jeff was having. There was, you know, 20 or 30 people standing around, walking by, tourists, locals, listening to this dialogue. And I'm sure it impacted the way that they think. I don't know how much it impacted this gentleman. You know, you can see there's sort of a flicker of realization in his eyes towards the end of the interview. But, you know, we don't have to reach everybody. And I think that's an important thing to realize. This country is very divided right now, but it's sort of a razor thin margin. Mm-hmm. So if we can go out there and we can reach people, you know, with open hearts and minds with this film, I feel like we can make a real difference.
Jeff, you walk this man through very clearly an argument that refutes all of his points. Do you think he heard you?
Oh, I'm fairly sure he heard me. And as Sarah and Emily say, I make no claim that we've changed his mind or his heart, but I think he was expecting me to scream at him. And he was expecting something very different. And it, you know, I think as we walked away, what you can see even through the mirrored sunglasses that he's wearing is this did not go the way I expected it to go. And he and his friends showed up later at a protest in front of the John C. Calhoun monument that has now been taken down, I will mention. Mm-hmm. And they were taking pictures of us, and they were probably trying to intimidate us. And, you know, so it is what it is. But as Sarah said, there were other people watching. And I agree with what Sarah said, which is if I had been there at the beginning, I don't know that he would have talked to us. So I will say this very quickly. I screened this film for someone, a group of criminal defense lawyers, and a young man in the Army in the JAG Corps came up to me afterwards and he said, I want to thank you for the way you talked to that man, because that man is every male person in my family. And when I show this film to my family and they see you talking to him and giving him respect instead of yelling and screaming at him, it's going to make it easier for me to have this conversation with people in my family. And so, you know, I was very angry at him. I wanted to say a lot of things to him, but that would have made me feel good. Yeah, I told him, but it doesn't do anything to move this thing to a different place.
We're discussing the film Who We Are, A Chronicle of Racism in America. We'll have more with Jeffrey Robinson, Sarah, and Emily Kunstler after a quick break. This is All of It. This is All of It. I'm Allison Stewart. My guests this hour are Jeffrey Robinson and producers and directors Emily and Sarah Kunstler. We're talking about their film, Who We Are, A Chronicle of American Racism in America. It is currently in theaters. So, you know, obviously the film takes us to Memphis. It takes us to Tulsa. It takes us through the South. But New York does not get off easy, our city. Jeffrey, please explain New York's role in securing white supremacy as part of the country's history.
Would you say that again, please? Please explain
New York's role.
Oh, New York's role.
Yeah.
Stacy Toussaint is a woman that leads a tour in New York City. And Sarah and Emily and I went on this tour with the cameras and we were shocked. When I was a deputy legal director at the ACLU, I lived part-time in New York, and the apartment, tiny little apartment I stayed in was maybe 300 steps from that building. I walked past it every single day. And then she takes us to that building and I'm like, what are we doing here? And she says, well, this is where essentially all of the cotton exchange work occurred and the money that came into New York. I think she said $200 million in that period's time. And then she took us to the corner of Water and Wall Street, which is, again, you know, within two or three blocks of where I lived and of where the ACLU offices are. And there was an open slave mart there where enslaved people were sold, were rented out. And so, you know, I was blown away by this. And finally, there is a young woman who was working as an intern for me. And she told me, you know, the mayor of New York City wanted to leave the union so that New York could deal openly with the South. And I said, that's ridiculous. And she came into my office one day and slammed this thing down on my desk and was like, read that. And she was right. So these were facts that, you know, takes the myth of the pure North and the evil South out of the mix. And it was all of this stuff that was overwhelming to me. And as a result, on March 31st of last year, I left the ACLU. I left a job where I was one of three deputy legal directors. And what I was in charge of was the ACLU's work on criminal justice and racial justice. And I left for two reasons. Number one, there were incredibly talented people, younger people at the ACLU who were ready to step up in the roles of leadership. And number two, I felt like this miseducation of America, the attempt to erase our true history, was at the foundation of so many problems. And there are other things, other people, other institutions, other organizations that are dealing with this. But I felt that the education of America, our youth, our communities, our government and corporate leaders, I felt that if we don't do that, we're in trouble at this tipping point. So I left the ACLU and founded the Who We Are Project. And we are going to be, this movie is just the first thing that the Who We Are Project has done. And it is the first thing that you will see us collaborate with Off Center Media and Sarah and Emily Kunstler on. We've got more coming.
Sarah and Emily, there's a few themes that were really interesting, and particularly the conversation about symbolism versus history and how symbols become more powerful than true history itself. Sarah, I'll let you go first. Will you explain what you learned about that?
I mean, the making of this film for the three of us was all about symbols, monuments, and place. The records of history that each generation leaves behind for the next. And you know, what was more powerful to us than the monuments we've erected are the hidden pieces of history, the hidden memories of history that are hiding in plain sight. One of the things that we had the privilege of seeing were fingerprints in the bricks in Charleston, South Carolina, and learning that these were the fingerprints of enslaved people who had built that city brick by brick. Or in Tulsa, Oklahoma, the platforms known to the Black community now as the Steps to Nowhere, where homes homes were destroyed of the Black people in the Greenwood neighborhood during the Tulsa massacre. And these are symbols, these are monuments to that history, whether they're recognized or not. And, you know, part of the making of this film for us was uncovering and highlighting these monuments to a hidden and obscured history that are hiding in plain sight. It's not just the pieces of history we decide to memorialize. It's the memorials that persist, whether we like it or not.
There is a clip that I want to play when Jeffrey is speaking to Alabama State Senator Hank Sanders about the Edmund Pettus Bridge and efforts to change the name. And the first voice you hear is Sanders, and the other voice you hear is civil rights attorney Faye Ture. Let's listen.
Edmund Pettus was a powerful leader in this area. He was a former U.S. senator. Most importantly, he was the Grand Dragon of the Ku Klux Klan.
Highest leader.
When this bridge was completed, I think in 1940 or so, they wanted a symbol. They wanted to name the bridge after somebody who would send the signal of stay in your place, because symbols are more powerful than words. And so this is a very powerful symbol. Every time someone crossed the Edmund Pettus Bridge, it gets in them. Every time someone sees a photo of it, it gets in them. Every time one sees something on TV, it gets in them. So that's why in the Senate, I got introduced a resolution to change the name from Edmund Pettus Bridge to the Freedom Bridge.
And the state of Alabama last year passed a law that said you cannot change the names of any of these so-called iconic white supremacist symbols.
That is from Who We Are, A Chronicle of Racism in America. The film is in theaters now. I'm speaking with Jeffrey Robinson, producers and directors Emily and Sarah Kunstler. We only have a few more minutes. Jeffrey, you know, I just want to ask you your reflections on MLK Day.
I think one of the things that has always bothered me about this day is that people who live their life in a way that rejects everything this man stood for call out his name. I saw Kevin McCarthy say, oh, Martin Luther King, we should follow him. And it's just like, you know, it's easy to say. And I think one of the things that you see in this film are statements that Dr. King made, like that dream speech I gave in 1963. Well, that's turned into a nightmare. And Americans don't see that part of Martin Luther King. And so my reflections on this day are always that what this man said was actually absolutely crystal clear. And as opposed to talking about it, I would prefer to do something about it.
The name of the film is Who We Are, A Chronicle of Racism in America. You can see it in theaters now. I've got my 13-year-old upstairs watching it right now.
Thank you. Thank you very much for that.
And thank you for making it. I really appreciate it. Sarah and Emily Kunstler and Jeffrey Robinson have been my guests. Thanks very much.
Thanks so much for having us. Thank you.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.